Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
It's time for Radio Vermont News and Public Affair Program, Open Mic with Ken Squire. The phone lines to speak with Ken are open at 802-244-1777 and toll-free 1-877-291-8255. And here's your host, Ken Squire.
Thank you very much, McLeod. Ready to go. Red Sox won 4-2.
Finally caged those Orioles.
Yeah, well, good on them. Where do we go tonight?
Nowhere. Weekend series with another bird team, the Blue Jays.
Okay. Boy, as this program expanded today, the feature of this first hour is going to be a conversation about ticks. What you should know about them, questions as to why we don't know more about them, and I certainly hope you'll help us by calling 877-291-8255 in the Adirondacks, the Green Mountains, or the White Mountains, toll-free. I found a story last night. I want to thank Eric, our Eric here. I thank him for everything. But my friend Eric Neely, who put me on to Donald Cook. The SS Donald Cook is the destroyer in the Black Sea that was zipped about 31 times, and some of them right down on the deck. So why is that a big deal? Well, Donald Cook graduated from St. Michael's College, lived in Essex, Vermont, was wounded and captured by the Viet Cong, held as a prisoner. They put a gun to his head, told him they needed some information, and he told them all the parts of the 45 that they held on his head. That's how much information he got out of him. Dead at 33 of malaria while still in Viet Cong prison. And his service was such that he has received the Medal of Honor. We lose track of these folks, don't we? Hear about somebody getting the Medal of Honor and unless it's a close rally, we forget about it. Well, there's a statue of Colonel Cook at St. Michael's College in Colchester. That's how much St. Michael's feels about this man. And I just thought you'd want to know another Vermonter who went above and beyond in the service to his nation, steadfastly just sticking to it as the Viet Cong tried to break what turned out to be an indomitable spirit. Yep. So the next time you're driving by St. Michael's College, give a nod to Colonel Cook, Medal of Honor winner. And the ship, which was built in Bath, Maine, is the one that the Russians are playing loosely with. Some political references they're trying to make to our being there. Certainly don't want that to expand into anything else, but to remember someone now and then that does not come up in everyday conversation seems to be an appropriate thing for a United States Marine Corps officer, Medal of Honor recipient, Essex Junction. With that said, this is a rather serious program. Of course, it all won't be. The second hour, that guy with whistle pig's going to be here. I love that story. What is a whistle pig, for pity's sake? Well, we need something to lighten and brighten our days because so much of it is so darn grim. And the story we're doing this morning, along with the Willie Beach Park, the problems they're having up in Greensboro with the global unification of nude recreation, going to hold their big outdoor do up there. Aye, George, they're under a lot of pressure. And I called my cousin David Rowell, and he said that he had talked to Millie over at Willie's store, and she said there were a lot of people talking about this story that was in the Hardwick Gazette, and anything in the Hardwick Gazette we believe is pure testimony, true stuff. So we'll discuss that the revealing story coming out of Caspian Lake. Stay tuned for that later in the program. Layton, I can't thank you enough for taking a moment to come by to discuss the fact that you darn near died of Lyme disease. How serious was it?
Well, that's a little difficult for me to assess. It didn't feel very comfortable on my end of it, but I'm not sure that I fully appreciated that I was near death at the time, although it sort of felt like that. But it's nothing I want to go through again, nor should anyone else have to go through.
Well, that's why we have you here, because we don't think there's enough information about Lyme disease, and it's more prevalent in this part of the world, particularly here in the Northeast. And come to find out, Corm, no Corm in the coach, has a niece that they thought was bipolar for years, Lyme disease. A fellow banker, not a fellow because I don't have a bank or anything, but a fellow I talked to at the bank, same thing. I believe it's his wife. Awful disease, and they didn't find that she had it when they needed to find it first, and it keeps getting misdiagnosed is the word I'm seeking. Now, why would it be misdiagnosed if it is prevalent in this part of the world?
Well, that remains a mystery because when I came down with it, first of all, I thought I had the flu because everything hurt. I had fever, shaking chills, the bed was rattling. And after 3 days of that, I decided to take a hot shower, and it felt wonderful. The next thing I remember is my wife saying, "They told me to tell you not to move. The ambulance was on its way." And that's sort of a side story to Lyme disease, because what happens is when you have chills, your blood tends to go to your core to protect your vital organs. You take a hot shower, your blood pressure goes straight down, and so do you. Hmm. But when I got to Copley, they rehydrated me, and they couldn't figure out what was causing the fever, so they admitted me. And I was there for, I think, 5 days. And it was only when Dr. Peters came in and said, "We're recommending you for physical therapy because you've been in bed for a week and you haven't walked." And I said, "Well, the week before I got here, I was bird hunting in Maine, and I was doing 6, 8, 10 miles a day." And when I said Maine bird hunting, she immediately started me on doxycycline. She had worked in Massachusetts and had seen Lyme disease and suspected that that's what it might be. And they took two blood tests that came back negative. It was not Lyme disease.
That it was not.
It was not.
Mm-hmm.
So I was discharged with the doxycycline. I went to my primary care physician to be tested again, another blood test, and he told me that I was lucky to have had Dr. Peters, that he had never seen it, never treated it, and would not have been able to diagnose it. And because of that, I have made inquiry of doctors who I know to find out that very few of them have much, if any, knowledge about it, including one of the docs at the emergency room, one of the surgeons that I've spoken with, my own primary care physician. And I'm finding that to be true generally. The other side of it is that any time you mention tick-borne disease, as you did this morning, somebody sitting next to you has a story about it. And it is everywhere. And it's nothing to be taken lightly. If they don't get an early diagnosis and start the doxycycline, you could be in for some pretty severe consequences. And I happened to be speaking to a nurse at Central Vermont Hospital this fall or this winter who worked on the cardio floor at Fletcher Allen for years. And we got talking about this, and she said that they would see people on the cardio floor who had hiked the Appalachian Trail, probably bitten by a tick down in Georgia. By the time they got up here, it had started to erode their heart valves. So it can be quite serious.
So that's the picture of what we have, and the lack of knowledge in the medical world is a bit of a surprise. Why wouldn't they be more on top of this?
What I'm told is that it's a disease that is spreading rapidly, and it only started in Lyme, Connecticut, you know, within our lifetimes.
In Lyme, Connecticut.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Hence the name. But one of the other problems is that when you get a tick bite, Lyme disease is not the only pathogen. You know, there are three other major ones in this area.
What's a pathogen?
Well, that would be the Lyme disease.
I see.
It could also be anaplasma. It could also be babesiosis. It could also be, ehrlichiosis is the other one. But if they don't test for the other three, you're going to constantly get negative results for Lyme disease.
While you actually have it.
Yes, and that was the case. That was my situation. I had anaplasma infection, and they kept testing for Lyme disease until we went back and tested for ehrlichiosis, which was negative, and then for the anaplasma, which was positive. But the treatment is all the same. That
all
was the
same.
Good news, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take to get you back on your feet?
You know, there's an immediate bounce once I started taking the doxy. And I took that for quite a while.
But you were out of work for a long time.
Well, I was in the hospital a week and then another week or so at home getting back on my feet. But, you know, typical of attorneys who tend to know everything and not have to read directions, I only took a half. Instead of taking it twice a day, I took it once a day. So I had to do another course of doxycycline. But, you know, it's as a result of it, I decided not to go back to Maine, which apparently is ground zero for it.
Really?
Yeah. And I went online and looked at bird hunting in Canada. And all the way up the coast of Canadian seacoast is a hot spot. New Brunswick, which is good bird country, it's a hot spot. So I thought, well, maybe southern Ontario. Well, all across the top of the Great Lakes is a hot spot. So it's coming, and it's something that's going to have to be dealt with. There was an article in the Globe, I think back around Christmas time, where there's a debate in the legislature in Massachusetts about diverting funds used for eradicating mosquitoes to doing something about ticks. I don't know where that went, but that's how serious it is there.
Well, you've done some additional research on it. I'd like to ask you about it and tell our audience, 877-291-8255, because this is new information for a lot of us. And the strangest part of it is that until I'd heard this from Leighton, and the reaction of the medical profession, that they're a little stymied, and it's pretty easy because there's four different manners in which it can be Lyme disease, and it's one of there's other things like that in medicine where if you get the wrong one, you can test for it forever and it doesn't make any difference. 877-291-8255. We're waiting for your calls, and we'll go to these messages right now. My guest is attorney Leighton Dottura, who was bitten by a tick. Pretty lucky to have him around. And his information, I thought, because he did considerable research as he was recovering and continues to do so, might be helpful to so many people that would be as surprised as he was to discover that he had gotten Lyme disease. And that there was so much non-information or misinformation about it. Don, over in Port Henry, New York, good morning.
Hey, Ken, this is John, J-O-H-N.
Oh, J-O-H, yeah. Huh? Oh, that, yeah. McLeod, he has a terrible time with Don and John.
No, we had a bad
Bob
connection.
And Will, Fred. I'm kidding.
Well, what a pleasure it is to talk to you, Mr. Squire, in person. And morning, Mr. Leighton, if I have your name right.
Dottura, Leighton Dottura.
Leighton Dottura, yes. The Lyme disease, is that true that it was developed by the military as a weapon?
I don't know that. Nothing I've read suggests that. Everything I've read suggests that it comes from ticks. And whether it was bred into them, I have no information about that.
Right. Well, I had heard that it was developed by the military, and it got its name from Lyme, Connecticut, and I was just wondering if that was true. And I also had never heard it being cross-diagnosed with bipolar disease, because I have friends that are bipolar. I also have friends that have Lyme disease. So that's quite interesting.
It's a whole different look at something we hear about and don't pay any attention to until it hits a friend or a member of our family and needs to be discussed more. Well, thank you. Thank you for your call. If anybody has any additional information, we're out here in the information department hoping to hear from you this morning at WDEV on the Open Mic program. Ted Koppel has a new book out called Lights Out, Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. And there was a paragraph in here that I thought reflects some on this story. If only we could defer to the experts. But in today's political environment, we have become conditioned to the notion that there is an expert to support almost any point of view. It's never been more difficult to convince the American public of anything that it is not already inclined to believe. Ours has become a largely reactive culture. We're disinclined to anticipate disaster, let alone prepare for it. We wait for bad things to happen, and then we want to assign the blame. I thought that was pretty interesting reading, and I would love to have had time with you to do a program about the issues of our cyber network and how we are, but we don't have time for that, and this is germane to the place that we live along Lake Champlain and around all these beautiful lakes and ponds that we have. So we're looking for your questions, if you have them, at 877-291-8255. So what did you discover, Leighton, as you began to get into this?
Well, there were things I discovered retroactively, because when I was in Maine bird hunting, I've generally been aware of ticks, because I went hunting with Tootsie. And those of you worried about infidelity, Tootsie is my dog, not my girlfriend. But so Tootsie. Every day when we'd get back to this little place that I rented in the middle of nowhere, I would check the dog and take a shower. And I never found a tick on the dog. But the deer tick is, they're in three sizes, the nymph, the adult male, and the adult female. And the nymph is about the size of a poppy seed. So if it got into a groin area under your armpit, up in the back of your hair, you'd never see it. But I never saw it, never felt that I was bitten. And by the way, ticks, like the rest of biological species on Earth, it's only the adult female and the nymph that bite. The adult male stays out of it.
It's those darn nymphs every time. Yeah,
they males are more accommodating, as I'm sure everybody agrees.
Well, of course, yes.
But also, they always talk about the bullseye that shows up, which is a red rash with a dot in the middle. I never had that. So I had no idea that I'd been bitten at all. And then going forward, it carries with it a level of fatigue that went on for some time through the winter, because I was in the hospital first week of October, and it was well into the winter before I started to get back on my feet fully. Beyond that, you know, it's hard. The other thing we know is that they don't fly, they don't jump. You have to brush against whatever plant they're on in order to pick up the tick in the first place.
Denver, is that the name in Stowe? Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I was curious on what would this cost you out of pocket after everything's been said and done?
You mean the treatment?
Yes.
Well, that's hard to say because, you know, part of my treatment was hospitalization, but I'm one of those fortunate folks that has Medicare and Blue Cross insurance to back it up. So the cost to me was relatively small, but I don't think that doxycycline is a very expensive antibiotic. But the key, again, is early detection. You know, if it can be picked up before you get to the hospital or while you're in the early stages of it, and you're treated with doxycycline, you're in pretty good shape in terms of recovery.
Why the question, Denver?
Well, I was just curious. You know, I have insurance, and if I was to get this, I don't have the type of insurance he has. I was just curious on what was going to cost me out of my pocket if I was to catch this.
That's hard to say. You know, it's
out there that are wondering the same thing. They don't have very good insurance. You know, I like to go out in the woods. I like to hunt.
Everybody does.
Yeah, the key is to early detection. If your doctor is familiar with the symptoms and tests for a tick-borne disease, that's the key. You know, and in that regard, if you ever do get to that point, you should make sure that the testing is going to test the full panel.
For
everything, because I went through it again. A couple of months ago, I showed up for some acupuncture treatment and had a tick on my elbow. And I'd been
It on your elbow?
Yeah. I was at a mediation session that day in Burlington. I don't know where it came from. I had a suit on the whole bit.
What the hell were you mediating?
So I went through the testing again, and I made sure at the hospital that they showed me what they were testing for.
Mm-hmm.
And I had started doxycycline, and the blood work was good. But a lot of it is recognizing the symptoms and making sure you test for all of the potential pathogens, all four of them at least. And there are others that go with it. But, you know, if there's concern about whether your doctor can recognize it, there's a wonderful publication that you can get online. If you go online and punch in tick-borne disease Maine, you'll come up with about a 17-page color brochure that the Maine Center for Disease Control has put out.
And the name again is?
Tick-borne disease Maine.
As one word, tick-borne disease.
I separate the words.
Oh, okay.
But it's entitled A Physician's Reference Manual. And it's wonderful. It describes the symptoms, the testing, whole bit. So, and it's something that's not bad to have for yourself. But if you have any questions about how much your doctor knows about it, ask and give him a copy of this thing.
And because it's surprising that physicians aren't up on this, is what I gathered from you when we first conversed about this.
Yeah, I was really surprised to hear that. But, you know, there's so much out there today that doctors can't keep up with all of it. It's impossible. There's just too much information.
Thanks for your call, Denver. 291-8255. That's an 877-291-8255 if you care to be part of the conversation, and we hope there are others that would appreciate the information. It just seems as though this is such a natural thing for Vermont, where people do like the outdoors, both around lakes and ponds, all that kind of thing, and like hunting, and as you have dedicated so much of your life to bird hunting. With what's that new dog's name?
Tootsie.
Tootsie.
But I'm getting another puppy this spring that I think is going to bear the name Brigid.
Brigid?
Yep.
That's a silly name.
Well, St. Brigid of Kildare.
Oh. All right. Okay.
Named after a Celtic goddess. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there is information out there about prevention. And some of it is chemical, some of it isn't. There's a chemical called permethrin, which you can put on clothes that will last several days and DEET on skin for a few hours if you don't mind that. But they recommend light-colored clothing and tucking your pants into your socks when you're out.
Freddie in Faison, thank you for your call.
Hi there. I have a question. I'm going to park and get off my Bluetooth.
Oh, for heaven's sake, I don't want to get you arrested.
I know. I'd like not to get arrested.
You might be a client.
I see what the scam is here. Anyway, so my question is this. As we know more and more how important the bacteria of the gut is in other diseases, such as Parkinson's, I mean, you name it, it's relevant. And I wonder if it plays a role in who gets this and who doesn't.
Hello?
Hello?
Is that addressed to me?
Yeah.
All right. I have. It's interesting you bring that up because I've seen an article, and I've only seen the title of it recently, that discusses, discusses the topic of gut bacteria as it relates to various diseases. I didn't read it, and I don't have any information about its relationship to tick-borne diseases. And I'm sorry to let you down.
But we're
that's
we're,
okay. We're, I mean, I'm just spewing this out there because so many things go through that our gut, and we don't, until recently, think about it.
Yeah, that was the sense that I got skimming that article, that it relates to so many things that are relatively serious in nature and chronic.
Like bipolar.
Possibly.
Well, that's one. That we have evidence in our own staff here, WDV, discovered that this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Short conversation coming up the stairs.
Well, at breakfast, I happened to mention I was going to be here today, so I could get both of my friends to listen. And one of them had two stories.
God bless you. You're a wonderful human being. Yeah.
One of them had two stories about people he knew that had tick-borne disease that went undiscovered for a year.
Hmm. Well, we need more of the stories, and it needs a broader window is what it needs, opened up, and people peering through and beginning to discover that there are some things we need to be concerned about if we like the great out of doors, and there's things that we can do to protect ourselves.
That's true.
Yep. All right. What else have you learned?
Well, let's see. One of the things I read, there was a short article on folk remedies. You know, the idea that if you put a lighted match to the tick, that it might. And the other one was petroleum jelly. But the point of the article was that the folk remedies are interesting, but they probably don't work, and they can worsen the situation because it might irritate the tick and inject more infectious fluid in. So those don't work. The other thing I learned was, how do you remove them?
And oh, good. But listen, stay right there. Don't go away. Can we take care of business for a second? But I'm going to get behind, and then Eric's going to get mad at me, and, you know, the usual deal. Our guest in hour one, Leighton Datura, victim of a bite by something that we've been hearing about and didn't know that much about, Lyme disease, what came about. Lynn in Waterbury Center has called. Good morning. Hello, Lynn.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling to share some information about Lyme disease for you and for the listeners.
Thank you.
Someone in our family, a close relative, was diagnosed last summer in Connecticut with Lyme disease, and they said it was Lyme disease. They put him on antibiotics. He became very ill. He was taken by helicopter to Yale, New Haven, and long story short, they did not diagnose a different tick-borne disease. There are apparently four different ones that can be conveyed by the bite of one tick. And this was one called babesiosis. And within 2 weeks, he had passed away.
Lynn, thank you for your call, because you are supporting the subject that we're into today, and what we started out with as we went on the air, that there were
four variations on this theme, and you can test for one and miss any of the other three and leave someone in grim condition, and you say that you're familiar with a case where the person died.
Exactly. He was a healthy, just retired. He was out golfing and, you know, outdoor things. And they diagnosed Lyme. They gave him an antibiotic that apparently babesiosis. Some of them are amoeba in the bloodstream, not all bacteria. So I only say that if, reinforcing what you're saying, somebody, probably not the patient, has to insist that the blood be tested in all the ways that they know.
All four.
Exactly.
Lynn, you're a blessing. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Ken. Bye.
And that's interesting because that essentially was my situation. They tested for Lyme three times and it was negative, and it turned out to be anaplasmosis, which is one of the others. That can happen when you don't test for all of them.
Hmm. Vivian Granville, good morning.
Good morning. I grew up in Virginia. We had ticks galore. I think Rocky Mountain spotted fever was one thing that we had to worry about. But when I came up to Vermont and the ticks started coming up here, I really was annoyed because I thought I'd gotten away from them. I was really sad to hear that they were coming into Vermont. One of the things I was, you said, your guest said that it was not commented on was the fact that he's an educated man and he took the doxycycline once a day instead of twice a day like he was supposed to. I mean, that's how the antibiotics are supposed to work, and if you don't do that, then that causes other problems with, you know, at large, with resistant bacteria and things.
Absolutely right, and we all know Leighton's a horrible person.
No, I just, and it is dogs, horses, cows, I believe, all need to be inoculated against the Lyme disease in Vermont because they can also get it as well.
Well, you know, when I was leaving the hospital is when they gave me the prescription, and everything was so vague and cloudy, I got a little bottle of pills on the way home and just took one a day and never read the label. That was the problem.
Well, that's because you're a lawyer.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. But not a golfer. But
well, not a golfer. I just want to make that point.
Huh. Well, thank you, Vivi, because the testimony we're getting here keeps centering on this, that we don't know enough about this, and that includes the medical profession itself.
You know, I read an interesting article down at Dartmouth-Hitchcock some time ago, several months ago. I was looking in their magazine, and they are starting a division to coordinate the millions and millions and millions of articles out there on all of the subjects across medicine. And that had a phrase in it that how else would you deal with getting 1 million bytes of information when you Google something or investigate something? There's a need for some coordination and synthesis of all of the information that's out there. And there's a limit to what doctors can keep up with. You know, it's a difficult situation for them.
Let's go back to one of our favorite places, Moncton Ridge. Fred?
Morning, Ken.
Morning.
I'm just calling to find out really about one question. Is there antibiotics or is there, not antibiotics, is there a serum of some type that we all can get or our pets can get, dogs and cats and whatever, to prevent the disease of Lyme? And I'll get off the air and listen to your answer.
Well, that's a great question because my wife is a veterinarian, and the dog is always has flea and tick prevention, and it's a cream or a gel that goes on behind the neck and at other spots that spreads over the dog that, at least when we were in Maine, kept the dog free of ticks that I could see. And I've asked her whether or not the same thing would work on humans, and she hasn't been able to find any information that suggests that it would. But for my money, it would be worth trying. I don't know if I'd end up being able to scratch behind my ear with my hind foot if I did, but I may try it this bird season.
Well, you bark enough. I mean, but that's a really good point, and thank you for that call, Fred, and appreciate that. 877-291-8255. It's about ticks this morning, and we're talking with Leighton Datura, attorney. Darn lucky to have him around to lead the conversation, and I hope we're all learning something. That Rocky Mountain spotted fever, is that a part of this?
Yeah, it is. They're basically, that publication from the Maine CDC identify, they have a section called Know Your Ticks, and they identify a deer tick, a dog tick, and a Lone Star tick. And the dog tick is the one responsible for Rocky Mountain spotted fever and tularemia, which is another offshoot. And again, it's the adult females that bite.
Get you. Well, so the first time I ever heard of it was scary. It was a fellow named Leroy Yarbrough, won the Daytona 500 back when, and lived in Jacksonville, Florida, was an outdoorsman. And all of a sudden, his entire character changed, and he became disagreeable and mad and so on. And shortly thereafter, he was hospitalized down in Jacksonville, and shortly after that, he died. And it was Rocky Mountain spotted fever, they said.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it does a real number on the blood. There was an article in Northern Woodlands, which is a great magazine.
It's one of the best magazines published.
It is.
Northern Woodlands, and they're down there in East Corinth, of all places.
That's right.
Yeah.
But in the article, they were studying the decline of moose population in northern New England. And they had tagged some young bulls. And in the, I think it was winter 2014 article, they were going around tracking down the tagged young bulls. And one of them they came upon was dying. It was 3 years old. And they took an estimated 40,000 ticks off that animal, and they had just sucked the blood out of it to the point where it couldn't survive.
Have you heard our new show, James Eiler's program called Our Nature?
One time.
It's on Fridays. It's a whale of a good program. It puts a lot of work into it, and we're getting a very favorable response. But one thing, it's not another damn politician. I mean, it really gets into the subjects that we need to hear more about, particularly in Vermont with our forest lands and woodlands and beautiful lakes. Robin Heinsberg, good morning.
Morning. I just wanted to mention that now out on the market I've seen and bought a pair. I can't tick socks. And the chemical
tick
that...
Tick socks?
Yeah, they're... They're set up so that the material that you normally spray on your person, like permethrin or something like that, will is embedded in the sock material, so that it's supposedly good for 70 washings, and keeps the ticks from crawling up your leg.
Who makes these socks?
I think I got a pair at REI. I can't give you a performance review until the end of the season, but they seem to be widely available. You know, Wigwam or whoever, they're out there.
Tick socks.
They're just bug socks.
Did you go to Lenny's? Where'd you get yours?
I saw them at REI, so I didn't get them locally. I'm sorry to say, I was sitting at home when I saw them. So.
Sounds like something, though, that needs to be made and needs to be talked about.
Yeah, well, it seemed like it was worth a try. If it keeps one tick off me, I'm happy. For not very much more money, it was, $18 or something like that.
Well, thank you for your call, Rob. Helpful. Rob in Heinsberg calling this morning. Ticks are the subject. 291-8255, and I thought there might be some interest. By George, there is. And people are, what they do on this program, and they do it on the gardening program, and so many of the things we try to do, they cooperate. I mean, they have opinions, and they share them with us, and that's where we think we score well, and really think that's why we ought to be here.
One other aspect is, what do you do if you find one on you? And all the reading I've done suggests that what you do is you grab, if you have tweezers, that's the preferred tool. But absent that, to get a piece of tissue and grab the tick as close to the skin as possible. and then pull straight up with steady pressure. And the key is not to twist or squeeze it, because you want to get the mouth parts out of your skin.
Ooh, okay.
Otherwise, you run the danger of spreading fluids with more infectious organisms, whatever they may be. Then wash your hands, because it can absorb through the skin or mucous
really?
Membrane. Yeah.
Oh, my heart. Okay. Mary Ann, hold on down there in Randolph. I've got to take care of business. There's so much going on. Here we go. Yeah, thank you. The subject, ticks, on Open Mic from WDEV. Friendly pioneer voice in northern New England, hung around for 85 years. And this is one of those subjects that's been hanging around, and all of a sudden it's prevalent, and we need to talk about it. Mary Ann, contribution, please.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for taking my call. And I'm calling because my friend, her son, got bit by a tick, and I don't know, it was like 5-6 years ago. And, of course, they didn't find it right off, and so he got sick. He never ended up in the hospital, thankfully. But to find it, and I think it's very important what the gentleman said, that you just can't do one test. You have to do a broad spectrum of things when you're testing for this tick thing. And now he is now 22, and he is just kind of getting back to normal. It was very hard for him because he couldn't do things, the fatigue, and he would get tired. He still does now, but not like he did. And I was hearing some talk about, there's some doctor down in Connecticut, in and around Lyme, who did a lot of work on this and finally gotten, and it was hard for him to get people to listen that they should test for more than just one, whatever it is, the things they test for. And he's done a lot of, you know, work to help it. I don't know what his name is, but he's down there somewhere in Connecticut. But it is a very hard disease, and people have to really, as the gentleman said, you have to be aware of it and make sure you get tested for everything, and it's a hard thing to get over.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Mary Ann. And Leighton, you had an experience similar to what Mary Ann is talking about, where trying to get information, and there was a fellow that was supposed to, that the rumor was a specialist at this, right?
Yeah, I had been given the name of a doctor in Vermont who I was told was a specialist or well-schooled in the treatment and recognition of tick-borne diseases, but that there had been some issue between that doctor and the medical board, maybe, or the profession at large. And when I tried to call, there would be no discussion about tick-borne diseases on the phone. I was told that the doctor would accept me as a patient in his primary care practice. So I never did get there. I also went online and asked for names of doctors who specialized in treatment within 100 miles. One was in Montreal, the other one was down around Brattleboro somewhere. But I never bothered, because the acute symptoms sort of went away, but for the fatigue. But I figured that was just a matter of pressing through it.
Cold, does it affect them?
Well, the article...
Cold, the tick.
The article in... it affects me. But the article in Northern Woodlands, they made the point of addressing that issue and said that general winters in Vermont will not kill the ticks. If you had, I've forgotten how many days, I think they said 10 to 12 days at 20 to 30 below, some would die, but not all. So I guess they're here to stay.
How are you feeling now?
I feel wonderful just being here in your presence.
Oh, stop. Now, come on. Do you fatigue more easily than you did before?
I don't. No, I think all that finally cleared up. But I was fortunate, though, to have had a doctor that at least had it on her menu of things while I was in the hospital and started the doxycycline right then and there, because that would have been within a week or two of when I was bitten.
Well, I would presume that in the coverage area of WDEV, there are a lot of people that need to hear your message. And I would hope that you might come back in a month or two and give us any further information, because we're coming into springtime, a lot of people out. A lot of people need to hear about this, that really care about our nature, as that program on Friday from 1 to 2 says with James, that really want to be out there, and we don't want to scare anybody off, that's for darn sure.
Well, you know, I think the big thing, the immediate message is check yourself before you get in the house. Check your pet, because it seems that the pet can carry it in. It'll jump on you. It's attracted to body heat and carbon dioxide.
Really?
But, yeah, but check your body, and you may not find it, but you got to check.
Leighton, I can't thank you enough for this hour. I think this is a meaningful one for many, many people. And look forward to hearing from many of the folks again. Leighton Datura has been our guest, lawyer, good fella, 877-291-8255. Don't ask for any more pro bono. He's done so much of it for so many, and he's taken an hour today to chat with all of us. Greatly appreciated. Now stay tuned for the dessert. Whistle Pig coming up in hour number two of Open Mic from the friendly pioneer voice of Northern New England. Well, we've pretty well covered the business of Lyme disease and ticks, and we haven't really scratched the surface. So that's going to be an encore performance for sure. And the strangest thing is, within the radio station itself, two cases of ticks. One of them, one of our salespeople, who as a youngster was bitten twice, and it was Lyme disease. And Corm has a relative that was really incapacitated. What did I say it was? It was...
Bipolar?
Bipolar, yeah. It strikes in so many strange and different ways. And because we live in the country, and we love our lakes, and we love our mountains, we want to spend time in them, and we have to be careful. But for heaven's sake, don't think you can't do it. But we have to beware, be cautious, and if we think that something's amiss, take care of it right off. Thanks so much. We've had a splendid first hour. Now, this hour is not going to amount to much. We're going to get into the world of the whistle pig. Well, you keep seeing the name, Whistle Pig. What is that all about? You're about to discover exactly that. And I want to go back on that destroyer. I think that is such an incredible tale. The one that they buzzed, 31 times, the Russians, and right over the top. And that ship is named for a Vermonter. First Marine killed in Vietnam prison. Incredible story. Recipient of the Medal of Honor. You know, we lose track of these people. We hear about them for a moment, and it is exactly that, and it goes away. Well, here's this ship, 300 men aboard, that has come back into the news, and sure enough, there's Cook's name right on it. If you drive by St. Michael's, you'll see a statue to Major Cook. Might want to pause and thank him. Now, where are we? Oh, we're going to Washington? Oh, this is some of the best in the whole show. Yeah, we go live to Washington and get caught up on all the salacious scandals that are going on, or other important news. Lori, who are you?
Hi, I'm the Pentagon correspondent for Talk Media News, but today I'm actually at the White House.
Okay, and what's your last name?
Lewis.
Lewis, Lori Lewis. How long have you been with these folks?
I've been with them for just about a year.
Oh, good on you. All right, so what are you going to tell us today?
Well, I heard you talking about the USS Donald Cook, and I was wondering, I think I heard you say 20-something buzzes?
31, I heard.
31 buzzes. So unarmed Russian fighter jets actually made two extremely close overflights this week.
Yep.
Overall, there may have been more, but the ones that actually came very close to the ship, that was two. So still a big deal. but not quite 30.
Why
a big deal?
Yeah. Why are they doing this?
Why are they doing this? Because it's a provocative action, right? It's a show of force. And it's Russia demonstrating its military might to the U.S. Putin does this. He likes to flex his muscles when it comes to the military, which we don't do this the same way, right? But militaries flex their muscles, right? The U.S. does so-called freedom of navigation exercises through the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, in the U.S. military's words, to preserve trade routes and make sure that China isn't militarizing this area such that other people can't use these waterways. Definitely, it's not the same, but it's flexing military muscles.
Hmm.
So I'm not sure what exactly Russia was trying to achieve out of this, right? There can be arguments for what the U.S. is achieving when it does freedom of navigation passages through the South China Sea. But yeah, for this, I it's really beyond me what Putin was trying to achieve.
Well, I think it's beyond anyone. I mean, it's sort of, once again, kind of silly. A couple of stunt pilots out there taking a swing at a Navy destroyer.
Yeah, and we actually had Russian officials a couple hours ago saying that they really don't understand what they called the, quote, painful reaction from our American colleagues, unquote. I'm not sure if we'll get a full explanation of why these buzzes happened what the end goal was. One thing that another official did say, though, is the freedom of the seas of the U.S. destroyer does not cancel the freedom of the air for the Russian aircraft. So I think that they're making the argument like, hey, just because your ship's here doesn't mean that our plane can't fly here. But again, provocative.
Certainly provocative out there in the Black Sea. Oh, gracious. All right, so give us some good news. Is there any good news in Washington?
Good news? News is all about the bad news. Some good news for the U.S., I can say. The president said yesterday that the U.S. and the U.S.-backed coalition, the 66-member coalition, has the upper hand against the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, that's ISIS. Saying that they are on the defensive. This came hours after the Pentagon actually said that the U.S. had entered the second phase of this ISIS fight, which now includes removing these militants from their strongholds of Mosul, Iraq, and Raqqa, Syria. So the first phase was limiting growth and limiting movement, destroying infrastructure, and now it's taking away these last few strongholds.
Boy,
so that's good news.
Well, I hope so. That old city is such a famous old city, and to think that it's going Aleppo and to see it destroyed as it is just tragedy. Mm-hmm. Ted Koppel's got this new book, Lights Out, and I was quoting from it in the last hour. And ours has become a largely reactive culture, disinclined to anticipate disaster, let alone prepare for it. And we wait for bad things to happen, and then we assign blame. Sounds like we hear it over and over again when we go to the Middle East, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, in that same line, though, I'd like to, since you're saying that, I'd like to bring up Zika for a moment.
Please, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Because same idea, right? We're a reactive culture, and I think a lot of that comes from what are we willing to allocate money towards? We don't think that it's worth spending money on a certain thing until the issue is staring us straight in the face. So Zika, of course, we didn't know it was such a big deal, but the CDC said yesterday that there's now evidence to definitively say that Zika can actually cause microcephaly, which is this birth defect in babies where they have an unusually small head.
Awful.
And they've also said that Zika virus in adults can lead to symptoms similar to MS or multiple sclerosis. So this is something that we shouldn't wait for, right? In pointing to the most recent public health emergency, which was Ebola, we knew that Ebola was a problem. Of course, we didn't know. We knew it was a problem, and we knew that it could turn into a large-scale problem. But it was a matter of allocating money to put in health infrastructure, and we failed to act on that until times were desperate.
Do we hear right that they're allocating $1.8 billion to go after this disease?
Yeah. The president has asked Congress to allocate $1.8 billion in emergency funding, but Congress has not actually allocated that money yet. Some members have said that that money should wait, or that money should wait to be allocated until the regular appropriations process happens, which is when Congress decides how much money everything will get for the year. They're saying, well, let's just wait for the regular process. But the president and his staff are saying, like, no, this is an emergency. We need to act now. So, again, demonstrating that maybe we don't see the problem as big enough yet.
Well, there's several hundred cases, right?
More than 700 cases, several hundred cases. I'm sorry, there may be several hundred in the U.S., but abroad, there's definitely more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And scientists have said that they expect this virus to work its way up into the U.S. Also, right now, it's present in 30 states, including Puerto Rico, to some degree. And, of course, some of this particular mosquito can't survive everywhere, but it could survive in some of our more southern states and our hotter and wetter states.
Mm-hmm.
And then also you have to think, like, Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, and that's a perfect breeding ground for something like this. So I think the government has a responsibility to look after those people as well.
So how long do we sit and twiddle our thumbs until we decide that the Senate can move on this thing?
That's up for the Senate to decide, and I guess that's up for people to press, whether people feel passionate about this or not, or whether they think that it's something worth paying attention to. It's up to them to pressure their representatives into.
I guess that's what we elect them for, right? Make the hard decisions.
Yep, that's why we put them there.
Did you watch Bernie last night?
I did not watch Bernie last night.
He put on a show.
Oh, yeah, it was good?
Yeah, well, don't know if it's good, bad, or indifferent, but it was some show, and you keep getting the sense that he's talking in the people's language, and the two of them are. Trump is doing reaching out to a commonality in people. Seems funny to put them in the same category, but people are pretty angry with that. What goes on down there where you are, my dear?
I know. Yeah. But like you're saying, this idea of the Washington outsider and what they can actually provide. I think it's like you're saying, there's a lack of authenticity when it seems like politicians are spitting sound bites, and when the objectives that they're setting seem to be poll tested, and that's not something that either Trump or Bernie at least appear to be doing.
And we seem to be counting the bodies in this latest affliction, which is coming from Central and South America. Well, thank you. Anything else that grabs your attention today?
I think something important to also touch on is that a report yesterday came out on the Chicago Police Department, concluding that the police in Chicago have, quote, no regard for the sanctity of life when it comes to people of color, unquote. You know, that's really, really powerful. That's something that's absolutely awful. That a report can conclude that they have no regard for the sanctity of life when it comes to people of color. And this comes after, you know, numerous police shootings, and as this issue raises in the public consciousness, something this report also pulled out is that 74% of the hundreds of people who are shot by officers in Chicago in recent years, 74% of them were African Americans, even though they only account for 33% of the Chicago city population.
Ron Emanuel hasn't helped himself any at all there, and the teachers are ready to go back on strike again.
Yeah,
it's a sad situation. My daughter, who's moving along in years, and she's moving back to Vermont. She graduated, a daughter that is down at the University of Illinois right now. We went out to supper after she graduated from high school. We had a good time, and there were the three
horrible grandchildren, but I'll get them back here and get them supervised.
Horrible, huh?
They're all terrible kids. You know, just awful. And they have no respect for their grandfather, none. And but we had an awful good time. And a week or two ago, well, now maybe a month, she called to say, remember that little restaurant you took us to after Cicely graduated? I said, oh, yeah. She said, well, here's the story. Last night, the alleged dealer was shot in the doorway, dead. But whoever pulled the trigger, automatic assault weapon, fired 24 bullets into the restaurant. She says, I think it's time I come home.
And that's awful.
I'm thrilled.
Yeah.
We need her in Vermont a hell of a lot more than they need her in Chicago. Well, thank you, Lori. It's good to talk with you. Now, what's your background? Where are you from?
I'm from California. Been in D.C. for about a year and a half.
Uh-huh. Where in California? North, south?
Grew up in the South Bay area, so about 45 minutes south of San Francisco.
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah, it was great.
Yep. What possessed you to go to Washington, D.C. and work for Ratner?
I'm fascinated by the press and hoped to get involved with it. Right, it's a conduit for, I like to think of it as adult education. And, yeah, I hope to play a role in that.
Well, I would say that you've got a job babysitting for the most part, and the babies are blubbering and don't know what they're saying. Just awful. But thanks for trying.
Thank you. Remember, I don't cover the Hill. I cover the Pentagon, so it's a little different. But.
Yes, sir. I'll salute next time you call.
There we go.
You're a good person. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Well, there's a new voice. We hadn't heard her before. Sounds like an attractive young woman.
Very rarely. I think once or twice. She's been usually out in the field somewhere.
Well, she's over in the Pentagon.
She is.
For heaven's sakes, if you're there, it takes a month or two to find your way out.
Heck of a building.
Yeah, it certainly is. Any sign of the whistle pig?
Well, he wants me to call him, so I'll have to do
during
the break.
Well, then here's what we're going to do.
Yes.
We're going to entertain the public with some more of those stirring announcements that make such a darn difference for as far as how this thing stays alive. And thank you all in the first hour for so many good phone calls. I think you've really contributed to the information for so many that are probably on the road and don't feel comfortable talking while they're driving, and that's what we're supposed to not do. Yeah, really, it was an interesting hour, and it hits close to home.
It's frightening.
Yeah. All right, then. The stage is yours, McLeod. See what you can do. And we'll need a weather forecast when we come back. Thank you. It's the open mic program from Radio Vermont, WDEV, serving Northern New England for 85 years with this and that. That first hour was a humdinger, huh?
Very interesting. And, of course, I know probably 8 people who have gone through that and some who are still suffering.
And the phone calls continue to come in.
Yes.
From people who attribute whatever it was to Lyme disease. It's a nasty situation. And we need to be aware because we don't want to give up our interest in nature and the out-of-doors, lakes and rivers up in the mountains. But it sure changes your attitude about what you need to know. And I want to thank Leighton Datura, he's a terrific guy, and sharing with you about what happened to him and how he's recovered. So you were so good and contributing to that part of the day that I thought it was only appropriate that I end my 3-day seance with you with a touch of dessert. What have we got for weather today?
Well, today it's going to be just like yesterday, just warmer. High at about 50, sunny all day, blue skies.
Well, see, there you are.
Yeah.
Loving Vermont for what it is.
When that happens.
What's a whistle pig? You have any idea?
It's very tasty.
Well, it's a rye is what it is.
They've got a variety. I've been down to where they distilled that.
Really?
It's over by between Shoreham and
so
Middlebury.
So let me tell you, but before we
yes.
get him on the air.
Okay.
How in God's name do you pronounce his last name?
Well, I think he'll tell us.
Oh, he's on already?
Well, he's ready when you're ready to have him.
Well, I'd certainly like to talk with him.
All right,
here
we go.
I feel a little embarrassed to bring on a guy named Raj and ask him how he pronounces his last name.
Hello?
Raj Bhakta, my friend. Raj Bhakta. Like Johann Sebastian Bach.
Oh, for
without him. The ta.
Oh, for pity's sake. Okay. Bhakta, huh?
Yes.
So what's a whistle pig?
So actually, it's interesting, Ken. It goes back. I was walking in the woods over 10 years ago out in Colorado. In fact, up in the Rockies, and this crazy looking French guy pops out of a bush for lack of a better or quicker explanation, and asks me, you know, could it be a whistle pig in this very thick high pitched French accent? I had no idea what he was talking about. He asked again, which is why that name stuck in my head, which is why when I bought the farm in Vermont, you know, 10 years after, that I named it Whistle Pig Farm. But it turns out that it's a colloquialism for a groundhog, primarily used in Appalachia. But I didn't know that then.
So we woodchucks are really whistle pigs?
There you go.
Is that what you're trying to tell me?
It's full circle now.
Oh, my heart. Imagine that.
It's full circle.
We knew all the time and didn't give it the proper credence that it.
And there you go. And it takes a guy named Raj Bhakta coming from Pennsylvania to bring it to you. Irony.
I'll tell you what the irony is. See, I'm boy, am I on your side?
That's good to hear.
Because that whole business, and there's a historical note to Whistle Pig, and they talk about the. Tea in the Boston Harbor and all of that. But the bigger point was that the reason that those first people, they were all the common men in the Revolutionary War, and we really screwed them out of their money. We didn't pay them. We gave them this script and gave them this vision of a place on the far west, which in those days was Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where the three mm-hmm. rivers came together.
Mm-hmm.
And out they traipsed, and they went out there and took their families, and then discovered it was a jungle. And they were going to clear land, and they were going to become farmers in this Valhalla and all this stuff. And they got there, and it was hard digging. What's more, they didn't have any place to get the produce back east before it rotted. Wheat, etc., rye, whatever you planted. And these people were, you know, the kind of inventive, ingenious people that we've had as part of our pioneer stock. And they said, well, we know how to fix that. We've done it for 1,000 years in the country we came from, or countries. And they proceeded to brew up a little stuff, put it in a cask, and head it out west, south, east, back toward Philadelphia and other metropolitan areas. And they changed the official beverage, as you point out, of the American Revolution from rum to rye, and a glorious day. And then, of course, the speculators, those birds, they got back into it. They made sure that they paid for the generals, George and all the rest, and the poor guys out there got stuck again. A guy named Hamilton came along and put an excise tax on all that beautiful whiskey that was being produced out there along the Monongahela. The fact that you even know that story, I love you for it. The official beverage of the Revolutionary War.
No, it's true. And interesting, you're talking about the Whiskey Rebellion. I think it was the last time, the last and only time that an American president commanded a standing army.
Yeah, 6,000 of them.
Yeah,
marched out there to try to straighten out those folks, and they didn't do a very good job of it because they still produce some darn good stuff.
Yeah, and the speculators are still around too, huh?
Hello, have you noticed that? Oh, it must be you're an entrepreneur. Yeah, how big an entrepreneur are you? How are you coming with Whistle Pig?
You know, look, I think I'm proud to admit. And to proclaim that, you know, our aspirations as a brand are significant. I think that there are large-scale changes in consumer preference that are going to be, you know, that are going to be highly beneficial to brands like ours. You know, we it started out, in fact,
to be very frank about it, it was speculation. I speculated that there was going to be a significant rise in interest on the part of the American people to rye whiskey, that it was, you know, it was a superb grain to make whiskey from that had largely become forgotten due to, you know, the accidents of history, which history is full of in every area. Thought it was coming back, made a huge bet, cornered the entire old rye whiskey market on the back largely of Canadian rye, which was the best that that existed then and now. Had a great master distiller that helped me unload uncover the load, you know, brought it here and used it as the basis to start up the only distillery of its sort in the world, certainly on our scale, where we're growing our own rye, we're distilling our own rye, I'm putting it in barrels that were harvested from oaks that we made on our own 700 acres of forest here in the farm, and cut it and used our own, you know, water from the farm. So it's taking craft to a whole new level, Ken, and we're gonna be a big brand and a global force in the whiskey business that's 100% farm based. I'm proud of that.
Don't you love that, McLeod? Huh? Where's the farm?
I do.
Yeah, it's in Shoreham. Oh. So interesting little other, Ken, since you're into history, and I would presume then that your listeners are, little known fact that it was the first victory of the Americans over British arms that was launched right here out of Shoreham.
Mm-hmm.
That went over during the night, captured the fort at Ticonderoga, went into the British commander with pistol up to his head in his bed. You know, sort of, he was compelled to surrender quickly.
Oh, stop! That is so silly. They were all asleep. Yeah,
I love it. I love it, though. I love it. That's American pluck and daring, right?
Yeah,
there.
And you've got that right. Yeah.
And took those guns. So that launched out of Shoreham. And I'd like to think that perhaps some of those guys fueled up their courage tanks with a little rye as they went over.
Well, they not only did it then, but they did such a Methodist job because they had that sort of semi-bridge back across that when the Brits came back down, what was that guy's name? Not Cornwallis, the other fellow. And so they moved out of there and built a fort on the other side of Lake Champlain, and they left a battery behind, at least one cannon that could fire a shot. Unfortunately, they also left a couple of casks of, and they got completely blotto, and the British walked across, took the cannon, and went looking for Seth Warner.
Hey, is that Mount Independence, I think it's called, right?
Yeah, well, no, yeah, and that's the best Revolutionary War battlefield that there is in North America.
Is that right?
Yeah, down there, what's the town? Right there.
Orwell, maybe.
No.
Well, there's Shoreham, and then there's
no,
Orwell.
Right, next to it. For pity's sake, I'm embarrassed. I love to go there.
On Lake Champlain.
No. This is inland. It's over on the lake.
Hubbardton.
Hubbardton battle.
Oh, yeah.
I beg your pardon to everybody around Hubbardton. For pity's sake, that's a terrible error.
There you go.
Yeah.
Another guy named Raj Bach that brought the Vermonters a name. Huh?
Yeah. And Seth Warner, that's where he really shined. And, of course, we do know that the general that marched in there along with Ethan was a guy named Benedict Arnold.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear, Raj, the story about why Benedict Arnold changed sides? He'd been up to be a general three times. And back in those days, it was always appointed by Congress. And they never would do it. And, you know, he'd won for them at Saratoga. He got a leg nearly shot off up in Quebec City. And he got so sick and tired. And he happened to marry a little number that was more British than anything else. And he just had it with Congress and said, this thing is never going to work. Said goodbye and left. And it's that same Congress, and they haven't done anything since. Well, that's not true. But it's sort of semi-accurate, but because
no, you know, I mean, I knew that, you know, obviously there was a level of disaffection, but the thing that really interesting part of that story is I didn't realize, like, his wife was apparently a great beauty and a great manipulator of the day. She snowed Washington and Hamilton.
Exactly. Yeah.
you know, that he wasn't really, you know, she was a good one. You know, maybe she's the one who got him.
Well, she did. I mean, she was a hot number.
And, yeah, here she was just so gorgeous and very charming.
Yes.
Dangerous kind of woman.
Philadelphia girl, right. Yeah.
Well, got to beware of these Philadelphians.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, we're wandering off topic, aren't we?
Yes.
Wait, hang in, Raj. We have to take care of Enterprise for a moment here, or we will be bankrupt. And we'll be right back with more from the Whistle Pig. Stay tuned. So here's the story. Our NBF, our new best friend, Raj, huh? He ran for... Listen to this. This is a story by Dan D'Ambrosio in the Free Press. Did you actually ride an elephant across the Rio Grande? Have I lost him? I got a new best friend, and I've already lost him.
He just dropped. You heard that pop.
That was it?
There's another call. Maybe he's calling right back. Let me check.
Please.
Yes.
I mean, this
Not
is
good.
A heck of a story. He
Stressful.
Rode an elephant across the Rio Grande at the Mexican border, making the point that illegal immigrants had a free pass into the country. Have we got him back? We're trying, ladies and gentlemen, huh? Massive communications problem here at Radio Central. Is he there? Hello?
I'm here.
Oh, my heart. I thought we lost our NBF, our new best friend.
I'm happy to be your new best friend.
Well, listen, this story about your riding the elephant across the Rio Grande at the Mexican border, making the point that illegal immigrants had a free pass into the country, you really did that?
Yeah. So that go back to 2006. I was running for Congress. Very, very bad time. I learned timing. I learned a big lesson on timing.
Well,
running as I was then a disgruntled Republican in a landslide Democratic year.
Yeah.
Not much you can do. So I really wasn't getting any press in Philadelphia. A guy named Raj Bhakta, Raj Peter Bhakta, I should add. Running as a Republican who came off the biggest reality show in history, I didn't get my first blush at press wasn't good. They had the story written and it wasn't positive. And I didn't have enough money. Philadelphia is probably the fourth most expensive media market in the country, where you can blow a couple million bucks with the snap of a finger on a determined campaign ad. I needed to figure out a way that I could get some attention to the campaign. That would be hopefully favorable attention, and it had to be a national story because there's nothing I could do in Philadelphia that anybody would cover. So border security was just heating up as an issue in 2006 then, Ken, and I said, well, what the hell can we do here? What can we do? What if I walk across the border? Oh, no, that's not particularly interesting. What if I take an elephant across? Yes, the elephant. I'll take an elephant across the border. What if I take an elephant with a mariachi band across the border? Then everybody will have to pay attention. Nobody will be able to ignore it. So it got a big amount of national press.
Yeah, and you lost the elephant, right?
Well, yeah, that was a funny piece. There was a drunk Mexican farmhand.
Yeah.
And between my really bad Spanish and his inebriation, we significantly miscalculated the depth of the Rio Grande there.
Yeah.
And when I came out of the water, I told the guy, I said, I want the elephant to make a brrr, you know, like that, it was a guy, like a Hannibal-esque in my mind.
Yeah.
To blow its trumpet, right?
The Jungle Book, right.
That's what I'm shooting for. And he says, no, the elephant can't, they only do that when they're in distress. And I go, okay, well, that sounds like it. We'll let it go then. Anyway, the elephant goes away, disappears. My campaign manager tells me, you see, Raj, he goes, that's Mexico over. That's where you're going to have to go if this elephant doesn't come back out, because Pete is going to kill you. And sure enough, you know, by the grace of God, the elephant came back out of the water, trumpet a blare, you know, in full distress call, and we got it out. And then I shot that clip, which, you know, was all over the news for a couple of days.
Yeah, lost you the election, I guess. Yeah. but I love the fact that the whole scam here was that it would be the United States that would be representative in your whiskey. and not Canada, because originally Whistle Pig was a Canadian company, right?
Well, no. The it was always an American company. So Whistle Pig was, I mean, I've started it here. So when I bought the, I moved to Vermont after I lost the congressional race. Yeah. That was 07, right?
Yeah, yeah. And Almost the Elephant, yeah.
Yep. And so I bought the farm here in 07. Really didn't know what to do next in life, Ken. You know, financial crisis hit. I thought I had made the worst decision ever. I'll tell you a funny story background. My father, who came from India, you know, in the late 60s, he comes up to the farm and he says in his Indian, he goes, "Beta," you know, which means like, you know, my child. He goes, "What have you done? We left this shitty farm in India to come to America to make money, and now you have gone back to a shitty farm in Vermont?" Is this what these white people taught you in boarding school?
Oh, gosh. It's hard with parental assistance, isn't it? Yeah. But what I like about it is that that you separated that whole business about American from Canadian. And,
yeah.
And because we do this all the time. We sort of forget that Canada is America, too, and that you're here in the Republic, I would choose to think, of Vermont, in the United States. Why can't they say the United States and be proud of that? And they have to take in Mexico, and they take in Central and South America as if we own the whole thing. It bothers me no end. All right.
Well, the I got a great deal. You know, this is the best part of the story that you hit on, Ken. I got a great deal on some, you know, fantastic whiskey that we took out of Canada.
Yeah.
You know, they were using it as a blend. They were putting it into a much inferior blend. So I bought the single malt, like really good flavoring stock out of Canada.
Yeah.
Brought it down here to Shoreham. And, you know, that's the Canadian piece. I love Canada. I'm very proud that we bought the whiskey out of Canada. It allowed us to start the business with a 10-year-old whiskey out of the bat, which made us so different from the rest of the whiskey companies that are selling two-year-old craft whiskey companies that are selling two-year-old whiskey for $50 a bottle, which frankly is a bunch of BS. You know, the for whiskey, you need deep age statements. You know, that's what makes the whiskey special. It's the cost, it's the time, at time, which is one thing that nobody can buy, that makes it special. And I'll be happy to talk about the following, because, you know, in the beginning, we got a lot of flack, for lack of a better term. Oh, it's really Canadian whiskey. First of all, I don't know what people have against the Canadians. The second, that we're just sort of faking it, right? The there is no more fundamentally real American Vermont-based company in this state than Whistle Pig, you know. And we're putting our money where our mouth is to an extent unprecedented for a company of our size. We'll soon be announcing, you know, probably later this month, up to $500,000 in loans for local enterprises who are willing and able to set up ancillary businesses that can help provide barrels that we need to buy. I'll put a purchase order in for 5,000 barrels, you know. So not only will we give them a loan, we'll give them the first orders to get into business.
How big a cask would that be?
52 gallon is what the standard barrel size is, 53 gallon.
Well, that's neat. That's really good.
Yeah.
You're doing good work.
A dollar a bottle goes aside to the Progressive Farm Alliance, which is dedicated to starting farm-based enterprise, as you know.
Now, hold on. Wait a minute. What's that? Back up on that. Tell me again.
So it's called the Progressive Farm Alliance. It's an entity that I spearheaded the creation of. We recently gave $50,000 to the Vermont Working Lands Fund. We're recognized in the State of the State address by the governor, you know, for as much. But it's dedicated to supporting value-added, farm-based businesses in the state of Vermont. The core supposition is that if we don't get farms working again in this state, we're going to destroy the landscape with, you know.
Hello. Yeah, we know what you're talking about.
Yeah,
we got it. And the point is that because those Finger Lakes are always what attract me over on the other side of New York. They go north-south, they're deep, and why isn't Lake Champlain to be treated the same? It's the same temperatures. It's the same everything. And as I understand, there's a couple of wine. Well, we got to take a commercial break. I'm sorry, Raj. This is too good to be true.
I'll be back.
Just hang in. Just stay right here while McLeod screws up the program. Yeah.
No problem.
So, Raj, listen, this is too good to be true. You know, following in the footsteps of the president, first one of the United States, George Washington made great whiskey. Don't kid yourself. He knew where the business was. And he also was the guy that changed us over because we were a rum army. And by the end of the Revolutionary War, everybody drank whiskey. And nobody could quite understand what that was all about until you got to think that Jefferson made whiskey and Washington made whiskey and made darn good whiskey.
I'm using some good role models here.
Yeah, that's right. And you're from India. Or your father was, your
My
dad.
My father's from India. I was born in Philadelphia, where America, you know, declared its independence, as you know.
Exactly.
Mother is Irish, but she happened to be born in Birmingham because my grandfather moved over during the war for work from Ireland to there. And then they both came to America, and my father, came to this country with $50 in his pocket and achieved the American dream. And I'm trying to take it to the next level.
Well, you are, and you've done it. I mean, you are the true American story. The whistle pig is a woodchuck, and we've got him on the program. A discovery. This is incredible.
No, I think we will be a more iconic Vermont brand than Ben and Jerry's by a long shot in another 10 years.
Well, at least one or two shots, and I'll be shot. Congratulations on a great start with the Whistle Pig whiskey.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're doing okay, my man.
Thank you.
And we really appreciate your taking the time to explain some of this to us this morning, because whiskey and particularly this part of the world, they sort of go together like sugar on snow. Yeah.
That is true.
Raj, thanks so much for coming by for a moment and having a chit-chat today. That's the owner of this enterprise called Whistle Pig. That's the silliest name I've ever heard for a whiskey. But we'll live with it. Thank you very, very much. And good luck to you.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Carry on the good work on your end, too.
All right. Take care. Well, now there you see, I told you we'd get you a little dessert, and I grant that, you know, some of you probably are a little upset that we seem to be featuring alcoholic beverages.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it's a part of our history. And McLeod's from Barry. He knows all about this.
That'd be more grandpa probably from Barry.
More, exactly.
Yeah.
And the best grandpa, yeah. Well, that's going to take care of Kenley. Oh, I had that other story I didn't get to this morning, which was of such consequence. Up there at Caspian. Hold on, it's here on the floor. So listen, tomorrow, Joel Nashman's going to be sitting in this chair, and that means it's going to be a special program. He's going to have Joel Selvin, author of Here Comes the Night, The Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues. Yeah, Burt Burns. In the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he wrote Hang On, Sloopy, Hang On, and Twist and Shout, and Peace of My Heart, and a whole bunch of those 60s songs. Yeah, the Great American Music Hall is where Joel hangs out on Saturdays, if there isn't a Red Sox game. But he's going to be here tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. I sure hope you plan to be with him. Oh, and Andy Potter's going to drop by, too. Well, that's it. Oh, I didn't get to the... Where did I put it? I had it here in my hands, and I've lost it again.
I know something dropped when I came in and checked. Is it?
Well, it's the major story from Caspian Lake.
Oh,
it was, and we know it's true because it was in the
Hardwick
Gazette.
Yes,
I had it right here. I don't know what it was. Well, about another strange crowd from out of town and moving up there, and they plan to open a nude beach, huh? Yeah.
Well, hey, you know.
Right. But listen to this. The Global Unification, I found it, Global Unification of Nude Recreation, going to hold its Earth Day, World Naked Gardening Day, and World's Biggest Skinny Dip event at Willie Beach Park. in Greensboro.
When's this?
Well, it isn't here. They don't have a date yet. Under federal under federal freedom of information in Vermont open meetings, letter reluctantly released from Greensboro, and global nudity is on its way, huh? Check that out at Willie's store. Yeah, at Ross Conn. Do you suppose this was an April Fool's joke?
What's that, about the whistle pig?
Do you suppose he'd go to this effort? He had a picture and everything. Oh, God, nude swimming, and it all sounded pretty good for a while. Thanks for being with us. We've had a swell time for 3 days, and you'll have a great time with the great Joel Nashman tomorrow morning.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.